Welcome back to the program. 1989 New York was a time in which social systems were breaking down. The crime rate was peaking, crack was a serious epidemic, racial animus was strong, and it was safer for black and Latino teenagers to hang out in Central Park than it was for them to hang out on the mean streets of their own neighborhood. Amidst this atmosphere, the body of a white woman was found in Central Park, beaten, raped, and left for dead. This is the backdrop of what would become one of New York's and the country's most infamous crimes, what was dubbed at the time the Central Park Jogger. My guest today, Sarah Burns, tells this remarkable story. Sarah's a graduate of Yale University with a degree in American Studies. She's now producing a documentary film with Ken Burns based on her current book, The Central Park Five, The Untold Story Behind One of New York City's Most Infamous Crimes. Sarah Burns, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. First of all, talk a little bit about the atmosphere in New York in April of 1989. What was going on, the kind of breakdown of the whole city at the time?
Yeah, there really was. It was a scary time. It was a very different city than it is today, a relatively clean and very safe urban center. In those days, as you mentioned, there was a crack epidemic. The crime rates were extraordinarily high, and people were afraid. I mean, there was a sense that being mugged was a kind of everyday occurrence or something that could happen at any time, and people almost accepted that, but they were terrified. And in particular, people feared black and Latino teenagers. They were sort of seen as the source of these problems in the city.
Given that the crime rate was so high, that muggings and these crimes were kind of everyday occurrences back then, what was it about this case that captured the public's attention and imagination?
Yeah, and this case was huge. It was front page in the tabloids every day for a week and then throughout the year. So it really did, it touched people in a very serious way. And I think that had to do with a number of factors. One, that it had happened in Central Park, which is this place that is, you know, despite its reputation as being dangerous in those days, still had this kind of holy reputation. It was the sort of heart of the city, and it was meant to be this bucolic and safe place. And so crime there, I think, particularly offends people. And then also, of course, you have this racial element, which is that the victim is a white woman and the accused are black and Latino teenagers. And in this country, we have a deep and complicated history when it comes to particularly black-on-white rape. And so people responded accordingly.
And this was a white woman who worked on Wall Street, who really represented kind of the establishment at the time.
Absolutely, and there's certainly a class aspect there, too. She works at Solomon Brothers. She's part of this sort of Wall Street generation. I mean, the city had been in terrible financial crisis in the 70s and was just starting to come back through Wall Street, which was booming in the 80s. But you have this huge divide between the haves and have-nots in the city at the time. And so she represents not only the white city, but the upper class, wealthy element of the city. And these kids were black and Latinos from Harlem. And so even though some of them actually came from rather stable lower middle class households, they were, people assumed that they came from abject poverty.
And the neighborhoods themselves that these kids came from were so bad that, in fact, you talk about one of the fathers told one of the kids, go to Central Park, don't hang out in the neighborhood.
Right, right. I mean, these kids lived actually in, to some extent, in decent homes and had stable families and all of that. But certainly the neighborhood surrounding them was a scary place. And the thing that I think is often forgotten in all of this, in this sense that the city was so dangerous and that these teenagers were to be feared, is that actually these kids, these same kids who we accuse of our problems, are actually the ones who are most likely to be victims of crime. So they're the ones who suffer the most from this high crime rate, from the drug wars, all of that. And so the city was a particularly dangerous place for them.
The other major character, major element in this story is the New York Police Department. And this was before Bill Bratton had really turned the New York Police Department around. Talk about the police in 1989.
Yeah, I mean, certainly some of the same problems still exist. But in that same sense that these kids were most likely to be victims of crime, they were also likely to be targeted by the police. And so in the same way that we talk about the problems of stop and frisk in New York City today, that was a similar question then, that they were likely to be harassed by the police for walking down the street. So the police, I don't think, were seen necessarily as protectors. Though, on the flip side of that, you know, these guys and their, and in some cases their parents, got into the interrogation room and they naively believed what the police told them about their circumstances, about being able to go home if they just made statements and helped out as witnesses. And so there's this interesting flip side to things where they had maybe too much trust in the police at the same time.
Why were these particular kids picked up for this crime?
Well, the Central Park Five were actually part of a larger group of around 30 kids who had been in Central Park that night, the night the jogger was raped, and who, you know, some of whom in that group were actually committing crimes. They were running around and harassing and assaulting other joggers and bicyclists, though not crimes that rose nearly to the level of the brutal attack inflicted on the Central Park jogger. And so some of the kids were picked up actually as they left the park, and others in the days following. And you know, people often ask me why the five were targeted by the police, and I think it's actually just the fact that these five in particular were most vulnerable to the police interrogation tactics, and so they were the ones who gave these incriminating statements. And the others who knew better, who knew to ask for a lawyer, or who knew not to say anything more to the police, were the ones who went home.
It is clear that the police did not really follow the evidence in this case. It was really a classic rush to judgment.
Oh, absolutely. They decided immediately that they had the right guys. I mean, some of these kids were already in custody when the jogger was found. And so it's understandable, perhaps, that they would have considered them suspects at that time, but they dove into this narrative of the case that they then constructed based around this idea that these kids were responsible, and with a kind of tunnel vision just plowed ahead, even as the statements that these kids gave didn't make sense, got the facts wrong, were inconsistent with each other, and even within themselves they changed their stories. And then you start to get the evidence coming in, and there's no forensic evidence that links them, no blood on any of the kids. The single DNA sample that's found on the victim doesn't match any of the kids. This is in the early days of DNA testing, but there's clearly not a match to any of them. And rather than reevaluating or trying to see if there's another version of this story, they just kept moving forward.
What was the theory of the case that the police department evolved?
Well, the theory was that there had been a gang rape, and that these kids had come upon this woman and dragged her off into the woods and raped her and beaten her and left her for dead. And once these DNA tests came back, that didn't quite work anymore, because there was a single DNA sample and it didn't match any of the kids they were trying for the rape. But rather than reevaluating, they said, well, and this was essentially what they presented to the jury, that there must have been another kid with them who got away.
This was also, coming back to a point we made before, this was also a story that was front page for days and days and weeks in New York.
Yeah, it was a huge, it was a sensational tabloid story, and particularly in New York City, but nationally as well. It got a lot of coverage, and the coverage was pretty extreme, and for the most part, the media really bought this version of the narrative that the police were providing. And I think there was a real lack of journalistic skepticism. And I've talked to a lot of journalists who covered the case, and many expressed some guilt or embarrassment over the fact that they didn't completely do their jobs at the time and really ask the tough questions that weren't being answered by the police and by the prosecution. And so there was a lot of language in the media, particularly in the Post and the Daily News in New York, the tabloids, animal language, references to them being savages, and wilding is this word that came out of this case and was used to describe their activities, or wolf pack, that echoes back to, you know, the coverage of the Scottsboro Boys in the 30s.
Talk about wilding, because it was a word that grew out of this case and took on a particular significance here. It was one of the things that drove the coverage.
Absolutely. It was one of the first headlines, and it really stuck. And it's, I think, still to this day, people associate that word with this case. When you say the Central Park jogger case, they say, oh, the wilding case. And that word initially came from the police, who told the press that it's what the teenagers had called their activities. But the teenagers don't recall ever using that word or knowing what it meant. And so there was some kind of miscommunication that happened. And there are a few different stories about where that came from. And I think we'll never know the true origins of it. But it really came to be associated with this case in particular.
The other aspect of this, which we've touched on, but which can't be understated, was the racial animus that was existing in New York at the time, particularly as it related to this fear that was so pervasive.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there was this the fear that we've talked about, of in particular of Black and Latino teenagers that we saw, but there was also fear on the part of African Americans of the police. There had been this series of violent incidents throughout the decade leading up to 1989, of all types, but all of which kind of ratchet up racial tension. So you get these police brutality issues, and an older woman with mental issues is killed by the police as they're trying to evict her from her apartment. It's a woman named Eleanor Bumpers. You get white mobs attacking and killing Black men in Howard Beach and in Bensonhurst. You have Bernie Goetz, the subway vigilante, a middle-aged white man who pulls out an unlicensed handgun on the subway and shoots four Black teenagers who are hassling him. And so each of these incidents just kind of makes the city both seem more dangerous and makes people less trusting of each other and more fearful.
How did the police get the confessions from these boys?
Well, I think they did what they are very good at, and these were seasoned, experienced homicide detectives, and they used the techniques that they are taught to get confessions. It's really actually very similar to what we understand the sort of good cop, bad cop thing, except that it's bad cop, good cop. And they basically convince you that you are in a terrible situation, that they have all this evidence. Someone in the next room is saying, you did it. You're going to go to jail for the rest of your life. This is what it's like in jail. I mean, they just terrify them. They yell at them. They scream. And then this good cop says, I know you're a good kid. I believe you didn't do it, but I know this kid did it, and he's in the other room saying, you did it, and I need your help to get him. Can you be a witness? Can you help me out? And so suddenly that seems like a way out of a terrible situation. And I do think that they also cross the line even beyond those accepted practices and into suggesting that these kids would be able to go home if they gave these statements, which, of course, wasn't true, and it's not something that they are allowed to do.
So this case goes to trial, and these boys are convicted by a jury. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, they were tried in two separate trials in 1990, and, they were not well represented for the most part. The defense attorneys were a mixed bunch, but I don't think the representation was great. And by then, it was such a big story that it's hard to imagine that it was a real fair hearing, even though the prosecution really had no evidence other than these statements. And I think there's one problem, which is that it's very difficult from the relative comfort of the jury box to relate to why someone would ever admit to doing something they hadn't done. And it's hard to prove to someone that that's possible. And so that's a big hurdle for them to get over. And I think there was so much anger around this case and such an appealing victim, and it just was such a horrific crime that people really wanted them to pay.
And they would go to jail, serve their entire sentences before we would find out that somebody else really committed these crimes.
Yeah, they served between almost 7 and 13 years in prison each. their complete sentences before a man named Matias Reyes, who is a serial rapist and murderer serving a life sentence, and who was arrested also in 1989 and began his sentence then. He came forward and confessed after an encounter with Corey Wise, one of the five. They met in prison, and after that, Reyes sort of realized that he was still incarcerated, and he came forward and admitted that he had raped the jogger and that he had done it alone. And DNA testing proved that he had been the rapist and sort of backed up his version of events in which he was the only person there, not just the sixth man, but the only one. And so the convictions were vacated, but not after they'd served their complete sentences.
Talk about these boys now. You've talked to them. They're part of your documentary that you've just done on this story. How do they feel about it?
You know, their lives have been extraordinarily difficult. They were 14, 15, and 16 years old at the time, really still children, and totally naive about the system, and they're thrust into this thing, and, you know, their families are equally, if not more, traumatized by the whole experience. And even after they got out of prison and you know, God knows what happened to them in prison, they were registered sex offenders and couldn't get jobs, and even then had a very difficult time putting their lives back together. And I think that having the convictions vacated, which happened in 2002, has helped with that to some degree. You know, it's easier for them to get jobs and work. Obviously, you can't erase what's happened to them, but they are, you know, they're getting by. They're working. Some of them have families and children, and they are trying to make a go of it.
When you talk to reporters that covered the story at the time, that in many ways fed the hysteria, how do they talk about it today?
Well, you know, there's an interesting break. So some people that I talk to express a kind of remorse or feeling of guilt that they didn't get it right, that they bought into this narrative from the police and they didn't ask the right questions. Others still seem convinced in the guilt. And, you know, there is that idea still floating around out there that they did have something to do with the crime, that though we know Reyes raped the jogger, that they were there with him or before him or something like that. And that theory of things has been propagated by the NYPD and by some of the original prosecutors and I think some in the media. When Reyes came out with his confession in 2002, there was some coverage of that. It was a much smaller story than it had been in 89, but it was still covered. And some of the tabloids that had initially really drummed up the support for this rush to judgment in the first place continued to do that by questioning the motives of the district attorney's office, who reinvestigated and ultimately concluded that Reyes had acted alone. They tried to tarnish the reputation of the assistant district attorney who was doing that reinvestigation. And so there's a kind of continued investment in that original version of the story on the part of some, at least in the media.
Having looked at this for so many years, what is your sense of that? Is there any connection between the boys and Reyes?
No, there's none. I mean, the district attorney's office really did this very thorough reinvestigation and tried to find a connection between Reyes and these guys, and they could not. And, you know, Reyes is a sociopath. He's a serial rapist. He committed all of his other crimes alone. It's not, and this crime fits his pattern in terms of the injuries he inflicted, the location. He'd raped another woman 2 days earlier in Central Park. He did that alone. He always worked alone. I mean, the evidence really only points to him and him alone. And so I don't think there's any valid argument to make that these guys had anything to do with the rape of the jogger.
How does the residue of this story still impact New York, you think?
Well, I think that the scary thing about this is that I believe that something like this could happen again. Despite the lessons we may have learned from this, despite the fact that we are more savvy about the fact that wrongful convictions happen, the fact that false confessions happen, we still have the same practices in place in terms of interrogations, Some cities and states have begun programs to videotape interrogations from the beginning, rather than, as in this case, once many, many hours of interrogation have gone by, recording statements to videotape. That's a great reform that helps to protect everyone in an interrogation scenario, but New York does not have that. And I think that as a result, this kind of thing could still happen. And I think that the Trayvon Martin case shows us that still today, the kind of suspicion that people can have about a black teenager, just for being a black teenager, you can be assumed to be up to no good, as George Zimmerman said. And so I think the fact that we see that now just reminds us that these same kinds of assumptions and prejudices are still around.
There is also something about the nature of these stories, and it's true of the Zimmerman-Trayvon Martin story, it's certainly true of this story, that once certain quote-unquote facts get put out there, they become part of the public consciousness of the story, and it's very hard to get those quote-unquote facts, even if they're proven to be 100% wrong, to get them out of the public's mind.
Right. I mean, and certainly with the Trayvon Martin case, we don't have all the facts
right.
yet. We may never have all the facts. We probably won't. But I think that it's easy for people to latch on to this kind of initial version of a story. And it is, I agree, it's very hard to reverse course once it's become such a big story the way that these have.
How do the police look at this story today? Do they have regrets for the way it went down?
Not that I know of. When the reinvestigation was taking place by the district attorney's office in response to Reyes's confession, the NYPD began their own investigation, and they created a commission to see whether the NYPD had any misconduct or other problems in the handling of this case. And that panel, created by the NYPD, not surprisingly found that the NYPD had not done anything wrong. And they have, I think, continued to maintain that position. And really the only way to claim that the NYPD didn't do anything wrong is to suggest that the five did have something to do with the rape, because to admit that they didn't and that they are truly innocent would mean that those statements were coerced and that the police had acted inappropriately.
And this is an NYPD that in theory has changed dramatically since 1989.
In theory, yeah. I mean, and certainly in many ways it has. I mean, as you mentioned Bill Bratton before, I mean, certainly the policies and programs have changed since then, and New York is a very different place, a much, much safer city than it was back then. But still, you know, we see a disproportionate number of blacks and Latinos being stopped and frisked under the current NYPD, and so I don't think that things have changed entirely.
Sarah Burns, her book just out in paperback is The Central Park Five, The Untold Story Behind One of New York City's Most Infamous Crimes. It's also a documentary that's going to have its world premiere.
Yes, thank you.
Sarah Burns, the book, The Central Park Five. Sarah, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.